From 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, it's The Bill. Conversations with entrepreneurs and innovators about their dreams, their triumphs, and their challenges.
Path. Every journey through entrepreneurship includes at least one unexpected detour. For AJ Bruno, the path to a successful startup led from Pennsylvania to Texas. There, a slot in an incubator program turned into a five-year residency for a startup that grew to over 250 employees. Getting closer to family meant moving back east, but a long-distance job wasn't on the roadmap for AJ. He turned one of the biggest challenges he encountered growing his first company into the mission for his second company, and he's charting another course for sustainable growth. It's the story of QuotaPath, coming up next on The Build.
The Build is made possible with support from 2820 Press, providing business consulting and content strategy services to customer-obsessed companies nationwide. More information at 2820press.com.
It's The Build. I'm Joe Taylor Jr., joined today by AJ Bruno, co-founder and CEO of QuotaPath. Welcome to the show, AJ.
Thanks for having me, Joe. Appreciate it.
Well, this is so for folks that know us, the irony here is I'm on the road today, and AJ and I are usually up the hall from each other at 1776 in Philadelphia, but we are remote, so we don't get to be in the same room. But I'm fascinated by QuotaPath because this is one of those great cases where entrepreneurs often come on the show and tell us about how they came up with something that solved a very specific problem that they had. I know QuotaPath, and having taken a look at your roadmap, is solving some very particular problems that I know I have in my organization. So tell us a little bit about QuotaPath and the problems that you're solving for your customers.
Yeah, of course. And thanks for having me. It is kind of funny being two doors down from your studio, but being in the building. QuotaPath is based off of my last 6 years of experience running a sales team and being so involved on the day-to-day sales. The basic idea behind it is that so many sales teams and sales leaders have these quotas that they have to hit, these targets that they have to hit. And to do that, when they do eventually hit those targets, they earn commissions and off of the earnings that they've done. And what we're doing is we're helping bring transparency for sales leaders, for reps, for managers, for sales ops, for finance teams on what people have earned and what they should actually be paid out. And then on top of that, we're allowing reps and managers to be able to forecast, but also goal track. So maybe they want to buy a house or take a trip to Cabo. How many deals would it take for them to be able to do that? And it's a B2B C app, so it's completely free for the rep and for the managers to be able to use our product.
So one of the things that you and I have talked about off mic, and I wanted to get you onto the mic to spend a little more time with this is solving a problem that I know you were experiencing in a previous startup that you had launched. So tell me a little bit about TrendKite and what you learned over the course of the 6 years you spent there.
Yeah, so TrendKite was founded in 2012. We ended up in the Dream It Ventures Accelerator Program, which I know has a big presence in Philadelphia, but they were running an Austin cycle at the time. And so my co-founder and I, while we both had ties to Philadelphia being the area, we went down to Austin for 3 months and just got everything wrapped up into everything Austin. South by Southwest was going on, and it was a lot of energy behind it. In those 3 months, we went from napkin idea to building a product. We actually had $20,000 in contracts signed by the time we were done with the program. So really fast acceleration. And we had this decision that we had to make. Do we raise? Do we keep bootstrapping? At the time, my wife and I were expecting our first child. So we had a lot of real world responsibilities coming our way. We wanted to end up back in Philadelphia, but the investor we ended up signing a term sheet with and raising money through was based in Austin, Texas. And because of that, they wanted their management team very close by. So we ended up moving the entire company from Philadelphia to Austin and starting in Austin. And that was, 6 years still going on today, 250 people, $46 million in funding. And it's grown really, really fast. And in fact, to the point where we were the fastest B2B SaaS company, probably in all of the country, not just Austin or Texas, but overall nationwide. It was just a very, we got caught up into this B2B space where so many people were interested in our product. And I got to be in the center of it because I ran the sales team. So you can imagine the growth during that time and seeing, and we went from a headcount of 8 to 20 to, I think, 80 in by the end of that fourth year. So very fast in terms of our growth.
And that is some fast growth. But the thing that strikes me hearing those numbers, those are three very different kinds of organizations. And those are very three very different kinds of skill sets that you would need to bring to lead that team. So tell me about how you evolved as a leader through those three stages of scaling out such a large B2B sales operation?
It's a fantastic question, Joe, because you don't really think about it as a first-time entrepreneur, that whether you're the CEO or you're running the sales team or any part of the business, at those early stage days, you're doing everything. But as you scale, it changes so much in what your role is. And in our Series A, we ended up bringing on a CEO. My co-founder ran product and I ran sales. And the conversation I remember with our CEO at the time is, look, I've never run more than a 20-person sales team. In fact, I don't think it was more than 10 at my previous job. So I know that at some point I might not be the person to run this and scale it, but I'm willing to learn and I'm willing to put my head down and just focus solely on the growth of the company, whatever it is you need me to do. So many, many times we would have the conversation of, Where am I failing to keep up with the process? Where do I need to get better and make sure that I'm trying to be proactive versus reactive? And so at the beginning, it's very much the art. The art of sales is just figuring out the sales methodology. What's the A to Z? How do I replicate this? Because that repeatability is so important to when you're building a team and you're training people and you're onboarding new folks. You need to make sure that they understand what you're seeing and how you're seeing it. So that was the next phase, was this repeatability aspect to our team. And then it started to become more of a science, because then you start to tie more to the financial plan and what the board expectations are. So then it became a balancing act between the executive team and the board, and then all of your managers, your directors, and individual contributors that help day in and day out. And I loved and thrived in that environment.
So I would love to learn a little bit more even about that, because hearing that your lead investor at the time preferred the executive team to be fairly close, you built a board pretty rapidly. For a co-founder to switch into a functional role and not necessarily the CEO, how are you balancing your commitments between, you know, your role as a co-founder, getting the company off the ground, the commitments you've made to the board, versus the very functional tasks that you have to do in that sales leadership role?
So I knew very early on that it wasn't going to be my last startup and that I was going to start another company and eventually run another company. So I had the mindset from the very beginning that I was going to be learning all throughout. And that's how I just took it on. And it is very rare for a founder, especially a founder, to take on the VP of sales role from day one and run that through 6 years through 20 million ARR. But because I had the expectations that was what I was going to be doing, I didn't really get caught up in either a title or an issue that I didn't have control over the product anymore. And I just felt really tied to what I was doing. I felt tied to the team that I was building and to the environment that was surrounding me. I got really thought about the people that I was hiring and coaching every single day. And that took on more of what I embodied day in and day out and focused in on. And so I think that was probably a big part of why I didn't feel like, bitter about whether we had a CEO come in or whether we raised and now we had all these executives and all these different parts of the organization and the company had changed so dramatically over that time. And that was helpful because it kept me focused and grounded in what I needed to do day in and day out.
So tell me a little bit about the moment that you realized that feeling in the back of your head that you were going to lead another startup one day. When did that start to creep up? What was the transition for you out of Trendkite and into what would become Quotapath?
So yeah, to understand that question, I have to go back to the beginning of Trendkite, because when we moved down to Austin, I promised my wife 2 to 3 years down there. I said, don't worry, there's no way we're going to stay in Austin long term or even past that 3 year mark. We'll be back in Philadelphia. We'll be back home with the family. We just had it our first. And during that time, we eventually had twin girls as well. So then I had a litter, I should say, of three. And so I knew that we were going to be back. But basically at year five, my wife sat me down and she said, hey, I'm going to move back. I know you're going to come with, but I'm moving back and I'm taking the kids. So while Trendkite is this monstrosity in a good way, of a thing, you're going to have to figure it out whether how you're going to balance family and professional. And so that really started, and she told me this like a year before we ended up actually moving. So that started down the path of, okay, what am I going to do? I can't run a 120 person team. I had honest conversations with the executive team, with my CEO, and just said, this is what's going to happen. And we made a plan that we'd go out and find the best sales executive we possibly could. So it made it an easier transition then. But even when we moved, I still was commuting back and forth for a year. And that was a lot of wear and tear with three young girls at home and just with myself in the airport basically all the time. Then at like the 7 month mark, I was like, you know what? I don't think I can do this anymore. And not only that, I really just miss the startup days. I miss building a product. I miss getting back to it. So where you hear a lot of founders take a break after that, kind of just reset, get their mind and body in a good spot, I didn't really think about that. I jumped right in. So in January of this year, I was already thinking about what I was going to do next. And I wanted to jump right into it because I was so excited and so passionate about going back to the early days of founding a company.
So getting fairly close together, the opportunity to hop back on the merry-go-round and build something new the second time, you're coming in with a different kind of model. What did you approach differently putting QuotaPath together in terms of the team you're recruiting and how you're bringing it to market?
Yeah, that's another great question. There were a lot of factors that went into this. First off, the space that we operate in, I had come from 12 years in the PR analytics space, and I really enjoyed having those conversations with customers, at the end of the day, I was just a little burnt out from PR and said, I need to go and do something completely different. And I knew sales in the sales space, especially as it related to technology, really, really well, intimately well. And I felt that there was going to be an opportunity building a product for sales teams, knowing the problems how well I knew them. And so that led me down a path to have conversations with various folks. In the meantime, my director of revenue operations at Trendkite had just dealt with a headache of onboarding a commission tracking software that was very enterprise heavy. It took 8 months to onboard. It was just a super big challenge to be able to do. And even when we had it onboarded, the sales team themselves didn't use it. It was all made for the finance team. So we would talk about this, and he was really entrepreneurial spirited and minded and wanted to do something as well. And he was actually the one to say, like, look, I know you're going to leave. I'm leaving. Why don't we start something together? We both have this great mind share. I have the back engine, back office part of it because I've done sales ops for the last 10 years. And you have the front of the house covered. This would be just such a great opportunity for us to do this. And I said, okay, you know, I've learned a lot from Trendkite. I think one of the things I want to do differently is just to do a different type of business model, something that's unique, something that's, you know, a little bit more inspiring. And rather than just going straight B2B, why don't we involve a consumer aspect to it? So that's what led us down the path of, let's build something for the sales team first that they can use that is free for them to use. And everyone talks about freemium, but we wanted to really create a value add product. So then that in turn took us thinking through, okay, this has to be product led. This is a product and innovation company. Trendkite was a very sales led organization. So let's do that differently. And let's focus heads down on the product, get as much user feedback as we can. But before we launch the enterprise, we're going to know this thing inside and out. And that's what we're doing today.
Tell me more about that distinction between sales-led versus product-led. I'm sure there are advantages to both, but what are the factors that contribute to the success of one versus another?
Well, for Trendkite, we didn't really know any better. Both my co-founder and I had sales backgrounds, and so we just assumed from the get-go that you had to sell a product from day one. And that's how it worked. And everyone tells you to get in front of your customers as much as you possibly can. But the thing that I think we missed out on, Joe, is that we were doing a lot of fake it before you make it. And that unfortunately caused a lot of issues. Sure, our growth and our new user, new business acquisition was a monstrosity. But the fact of the matter is, on the flip side, when we got to renew those clients and the retention side of it, it became challenging and we didn't have great retention numbers all throughout, unfortunately. So when thinking about it, I wanted to build a company that was customer centric, and the company that was the sales led was great. We had some great times because we hired two interns that did a lot of lead gen right off the get go. But I remember it being so much downward pressure for financial plan and expectations for us. And when we missed on those, it was because of us not being able to figure out the sales process well enough. Versus here, it's the expectation of, if we fail, it's because we haven't lived up to the value that our customers expect us to. Those are very different in how you create those organizations.
I think too, tell me about the challenges of selling to salespeople. I feel like you're probably taking on some Hall of Fame level conversations with, you know, don't play a player level conversations.
I've gotten that feedback so many times over the last 8 months, and being sales minded myself, anytime I hear an objection to what QuotaPath does, my first instinct is to like, no, that's ridiculous. But the fact of the matter is, don't BS a BSer, right? So I know a lot of the tricks that happen in sales, and I think I come into this with just an open mind and more of a, I really do have a genuine product conversation with these folks. Today, our product is servicing individual contributors and sales managers, and we're working our way up the chain to a VP or even a CRO. So when I have conversations with them, it's from the standpoint of like, look, I don't have this figured out 100% yet, but I want to build this product for you, and I want to make sure we get it right. It was a bit more disarming than the conversations that they have day in and day out from a sales standpoint. And I think when we do that, it just becomes an honest conversation, and I'm able to get the feedback better. When we're talking to individual contributors, it's all focused on the value. And yes, I totally agree that there's like a little bit of back and forth that we both know the game when we're having this conversation. And I think that that's going to follow us through as we build out the company and get larger and larger. But at the end of the day, if it adds value to the end user, then it doesn't matter who you're selling to. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
It strikes me as interesting that you're on a path that's similar to software as a service companies like Basecamp or Box, where the adoption is happening from the bottom end of the org chart up. So there's less risk involved when you're selling to folks in the low to mid level of the org compared to selling into the C-suite. What are you doing to make sure that you can give your users a clear path to adoption, especially inside larger organizations?
Right. And that, I mean, that's still part of it that we're going to have to figure out. I think the customer engagement metrics are things that we look at every single day, and how the platform is used. You mentioned Basecamp, Dropbox, or Box. Those are perfect examples. Slack is how we liken it. And I think Slack is great analogy, because in our application, we'll have a hierarchy where you can share compensation plans and different paths, so you can get that gamification all in one spot. We're thinking about it at the individual level, and then we'll continue to build levels on top of that. But it's something we're always talking about in our stand-ups or our weekly check-ins in terms of adoption and how people are using it, what users we've spoken to, what are we actually getting from it? So that absolutely drives our roadmap. And while we've made a lot of assumptions, like you do in any startup at the beginning, we're always validating the data. And I always want our guys, our folks, when they're coming into a meeting, if they're going to make a change about how we're doing it, to make it a data-driven change. That's the most important thing when you're building a startup, because you're just making a lot of guesswork. And yes, you should have that billion-dollar idea and you should go focus after it. And it doesn't matter what anyone says, that data doesn't matter on that. But when you get to the user level, the data absolutely matters.
So when thinking about your roadmap, I would imagine that it, in some ways, it's easier to respond to customer feedback when you have a smaller, more nimble team. How do you make sure that you're getting how are you making the right decisions based on that blend of data and customer feedback? Where do you trust the gut versus where do you look at the spreadsheet?
Yeah, and both my co-founder and I have a lot of conversations about this because we know the industry almost too well, and we don't want to just narrow what our focus is based off of our own gut instincts on things. There's a lot of conversations where we'll have, and we're like, well, let me just send out a message. Here's what the message is going to look like. There's sometimes where we do pretty formal surveys. Actually, we just sent one out to our network to about 50 sales leaders asking very specific questions. And we have a group conversation on that. But sometimes it's a little bit more off the cuff in what we're thinking about. It's definitely a delicate balance when you're building a company, where you don't want to go too far down without making sure you test it out. But at the same time, you want to make decisions that say, you know what, I know that there's going to be slight education in this feature, in this product, but I'm okay with it because I feel strongly that the intuitiveness of the rest of the product is going to make sense. That when they get there, they're like, okay, I get it. That makes sense. And then they're going to carry on with what they're doing.
Now, you're playing in a space that's dominated by software providers that come from both the very traditional enterprise sense, or even companies like Intuit. QuickBooks has become adopted, you know, far and wide. And then you have FreshBooks at the other end, guys like Michael McDermott that were like, you know, sleeping on his parents' couch to be able to cover the first couple of years of that company. What do you do to insulate QuotaPath so that you can continue to grow and build this product out in a way that it doesn't just, your feature set doesn't just show up as a new feature from somebody else's product?
You learn from them. I mean, I think Lean Product Playbook is actually built, that book was written by the guy that built TurboTax. And we liken to what our product does as a TurboTax for sales reps to onboard themselves. Those providers that you mentioned are more actually integrated with what we're doing. And the funny thing is, when you think about sales compensation, it's not a bank. So there's always mistakes that are made. Unfortunately, that's the way this industry is handled, that at the end of a quarter, a sales ops leader might come to the sales manager and say, here's your comp spreadsheet, this is what it looks like. And they go and like, oh, don't you remember this exception or this issue? There's a lot of back and forth. The guys that you just mentioned are much more structured and locked down than that. So there's a little bit of catching up actually in our industry, where we will integrate with Salesforce, we'll integrate with QuickBooks, and NetSuite even, to help bring the data that they already have at a company level all the way down to the individual. So the competitive space is actually pretty fascinating, because a lot of these guys are siloed in what they're actually doing, where we feel like we can bring a few industries, commission tracking, gamification, leaderboards, and metrics all together and help bring transparency against for the entire organization, and feel strongly that that doesn't exist anywhere today.
Now, shifting gears a little bit, thinking about how you're building out the team for QuotaPath, hearing your own story from TrendKite and that you were all in Austin, QuotaPath, you've got folks distributed in a couple different places. So tell me a little bit more about how you're approaching building a team that's not all in one place.
Yeah, we're not a remote team either. It's It's split between Austin and Philadelphia, and for the time being, that's where we're going to stay. It's an interesting dynamic that we have. So most of our product and dev folks are actually in Philadelphia, and sales and marketing will be in Austin.
Now, you would have thought it would have been the other way around based on how the cities usually market themselves.
Well, also, to add to the fact that I would be running the sales team and my co-founder that's in Austin is going to be running product. The reason we thought about it this way, first off, when I came back to Philadelphia, I wasn't 100% sure of what the startup community was like. I've seen PSL grow, Philly Startup Leaders, grow through this past year, actually. They have a fantastic executive director, Kiara, and their team is great. Bob Moore's done a great job. Overall, Rick Nucci as well. Overall, it's a really, really emerging community. And it's been emerging for a few years, but I feel like it's gotten its legs under it. So I wasn't really sure what to expect. But what I found is that there are some really talented technical folks, engineers here for sure. Our technical co-founder came from Monetate, and we've hired some great people that have just, they're at the top of the top. Yes, there are some folks that, they've ended up going to New York. They've graduated from Wharton, or they've gone to some of the other universities. But we really feel strongly that we have a great pool of talent for our engineering here in Philly. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to keep that exclusively in Philadelphia. We're pretty agnostic when it comes to the two cities. We're interviewing folks in Austin for engineering talent as well. So my co-founder is in Austin and no plans to move, but that's completely fine because our seed investor is actually in Austin as well. And I have such a network of people that are in sales and marketing that I want to work with again, that we'll hire a lot of those folks as well. But just like the engineering talent, if we find some great people here in Philadelphia, we'll keep it here too.
Tell me a little bit more about the distinction between working remotely versus coming in to a physical space, knowing now that you've been located at 1776 in Philadelphia. What does having a space like that mean to a company like yours?
Yeah, and I'm a big proponent of having a space and not having everyone work from home. There's just so much collaboration that happens in the office. I know a lot of slack is given to open floor plans, but I really enjoy it. And I think that I've just seen so many great things come out of it. I mean, we have a challenge that we have a space in Austin and a space in Philadelphia. And I think the biggest challenge is actually just the time difference. Even though it's just an hour, when we have our daily stand up at 9 a.m., 8 a.m., the guys in Austin are taking it from a car. it's worked really well. My co-founder and I were very hesitant about that. If someone asked us what's going to be your biggest challenge going into this, I would have said Austin and Philadelphia. But today, I would say that those two cities and what we're doing is so aligned. And it's been great because I think there's a lot of people that I'll hire in Austin that are actually going to move to Philadelphia. And I have a really good friend. She was actually Trendkite's first employee. She moved to Philadelphia and is working for Bob Moore's company. So I'm seeing a lot of people actually come up to the Northeast and check it out. Philadelphia is a great livable city to be in. And so that's been a big plus for what we're doing today.
Now, bringing it full circle, knowing that your wife put the shot clock out there for coming back to Philadelphia, how has it been for you to manage that work-life fit, especially with three little girls?
Yeah, and it's something my wife and I talk about a lot. She's actually starting her own business. She is starting a drop-in daycare on the main line, where you can drop your kids off, run errands, go on a date, which is very unique. This exists in Texas. It's the first of its kind in this area. So we have a pretty crazy household going on today. My work-life balance is very, very straightforward. I actually heard Jeff Weiner talk a few months ago, and one of the things that he just really stuck out to me was he talked about happiness. He said, happiness is being excited to go into work in the morning, but being excited to go home at night. And I think that has always stuck with me. And I just continue to say that that's something I try to live by. I leave the office in 1776 at 4:30 every day to take the train back. But I'm in the office early in the morning. 7 to 9 are my two golden hours for me to get stuff done. I think about it this way. People normally work a 9 to 5. You know, traditionally, I've worked 7 to 5, 5:30. That's 7 to 9, 2 hours. That's 10 hours a week. That's 40 hours a month. That's 3 extra months in any given year that I'm afforded back to me, that I'm getting ahead of whatever I need to get ahead of. And I really, really enjoy that. But at the same time, my wife and I keep nights pretty sacred to us. So no phones at the dinner table. Friday afternoons, we actually have off as a company. So I make sure to get back early as well. And then, of course, on the weekends, we have a ton of different things going on with the kiddos.
That's fantastic. So wrapping up, tell me your dream for QuotaPath. How big does it get? Does it remain a standalone company? Do you envision an exit or an acquisition? Where do you think this goes?
Yeah, I have no hesitation when I say that QuotaPath will be a $1 billion company. I know that that sounds jarring to maybe some of the listeners that are out there, but I know what a company that's doing $30, $40 million in revenue looks like, and I think I can do 10 times better than that. I think we as a group can do 10 times better than that. So the question gets asked pretty frequently in recruiting, what's your exit strategy for QuotaPath? And I think this early, that doesn't really matter at this point. I think if we recruit and hire people that care so much and are so passionate about what the business is, that the exit is going to take care of itself. And a lot of other questions I get asked about this, is Salesforce going to buy you guys sometime down the road? And you know what? I don't think Salesforce will be big enough to be able to do this if we execute correctly. So I'm really, really looking big for this, and I'm really excited to do it as my second time.
AJ Bruno, QuotaPath, thank you so much for joining us on The Build.
Thanks, Joe, for having me.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of The Build. Our producer is Katie Cohen-Zonizer. Our production coordinator is Nicole Hubbard. Our production team for this episode included Amelia Lohman, Jess Ryan, Faiza Samreen, Gianna Sini, and April Smith. Podfly Productions manages our post-production, and our theme music is performed by Arrows and Sound. I'm Joe Taylor Jr.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Build. We hope you'll share this series with your friends and provide us with feedback on the iTunes Store. You can also subscribe to weekly updates and learn more about upcoming guests by visiting our show page at thebuild.biz. This has been a 2820 radio production.